Well, good morning. It's good to be with you. Last time I preached here, I think it was 14 years ago. It takes a while to get over me and have it back. But it's really good to be with you. I enjoyed working with the young people this weekend because I really enjoy doing that where I am, having all the college kids at A&M and Blinn. It's just a treat to watch them at a very special time in their life when they are deciding if they're going to follow all of the stuff you've taught them and all of the things that they have come to hear and know. Are they really going to believe that? And it's great to watch them grow. There are so many of them that just transition in those 4 or 5 years that we have them, sometimes 6 and 7 and 8. But they do a great job. And I hope that we then, in turn, are a blessing to people at other places, because I think about all those young people going out and working with congregations in different places. Good to see Travis LeCour, his wife. They were dating, I think, when they were there. I don't think they were married yet. But Travis was just a special young guy to us. And really, I'd lost track of him. I didn't realize that he was here. But certainly glad to see him. Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate very much you being here this morning. I want to talk to you about a lesson that comes out of Matthew chapter 6. If you will, open up your New Testaments. We'll read there in just a minute. J.C. Ryle, who was a commentator back in the 19th century, wrote these words about this text. He said, "What are the vast majority of professing Christians around us doing? They are laying up treasure on earth. There can be no mistake about it. Their tastes, their ways, their habits tell a fearful tale. They are not laying up treasure in heaven. Let us all beware that we do not sink into hell by paying excessive attention to lawful things. Open transgression of God's law slays its thousands, but worldliness slays its 10,000s. Thomas Carlyle said, "For every 10 men who withstand adversity, there is only one who withstands prosperity." Jesus places before us, as he does in many places, but especially here, the choice between two options, two treasures. Either we will seek heaven or we will seek earth. Two spiritual conditions. Either we will be people of light or we will be in unimaginable darkness. Though we think we are alive, we are dead. And it all comes back to two masters. We will either choose God, or we will choose the Semitic word, the Aramaic word used here, mammon. Your version may translate money, but it would stand for all of those kinds of things that would be of that physical nature. We cannot sit on the fence. God is not going to let us do that. He's going to make us uncomfortable. In fact, he's going to make us very uncomfortable. And it's hard to preach a lesson like this because I look at myself and realize that it's just hard to say, have you conquered this? At all? Do you even understand how to conquer it? So I do not come to you this morning thinking that somehow I know the answer to these things. I am a pilgrim with you on the same journey. And there may be things in my life that you could look at and say, but it looks like you are given over to mammon in that regard, and you're probably right. But the thing is, we are going to look at each other and see things that we ought not to see, and hopefully by working on one another, can draw closer to the ideal that Jesus wants us to be. In chapter 6, beginning at verse 19, he says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body, so if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God," and I'll use the word mammon. English Standard says money, but I like the old word. "You cannot serve God and mammon." Well, the first thing that I think that we need to understand in this text is that what really matters in this life is where we will lay up our treasure. What master, of course, first of all, that we will choose. But I want to say, first of all, like we do many times with things, is what laying up treasure on the earth is not. It is not banning possessions. It is not banning savings. I mean, if that were true, then all private property would have to be condemned. But you know in Acts the 5th chapter in verse 4, Peter said to Ananias and Sapphira, while it remained, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it not in your own control? God gave possessions for us to have. Even Barnabas, who is a son of encouragement in that text that precedes this, it sets up the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Even those we don't know who are named. It says, there was none of them among them that lacked, for all who were possessors of lands or houses sold them. And then it says of Barnabas at the end, having land, it says he sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. So it's not having possessions. God is not saying that we have to divest ourselves of that and go and live in some monastery somewhere totally as poverty-stricken. It is not a ban, as I would say to you, on retirement savings, on setting aside for emergencies, on preparing for our kids to go to college. I mean, the Scripture praises, I mentioned to the young people this morning, the lowly aunt, by saying to us in Proverbs 6 and at verse 6, go to her, go to the aunt and consider her ways, that she has no captain or overseer or ruler, yet provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. So that God would want us to look in the way of wisdom at a lowly creature he's made that goes about scurrying about and making certain that it brings in all that it can. I mean, everybody at home knows I keep honeybees, which they also know we knew you were weird. Now we just have confirmation how weird. But right now is their honey flow. Right now, they are going out. I mean, when I go to a hive in a normal day, it's kind of like this. They're coming and going. Right now, it's like Aggies going to a football game. It's just frantic. Everybody's going. They're busy because they're bringing in everything they can. I'm going to tell you, God's teaching us something through that. And I believe he's saying to us in things like that, that we need to provide for our own. In fact, sharp words in Scripture to the man that does not take care of his family. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, but if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith, is worse than an unbeliever. So that to prepare for the future and to take care of our needs as we would get older, I mean, those things would make it the kind of sense that we see in the physical world. And then finally, I would say to you that it's not banning the things God gave us to enjoy. In fact, he says that. In 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, while he's warning the rich about the things they have, and we'll come back to that passage later in our sermon, command those that are rich in this present age not to be haughty nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, and listen to him, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. So God intended that these things that are on the earth, while they have a grave danger in them, they were meant for us to enjoy them, but we have to remember that we must let go of them. There cannot be this attitude that we're going to come to in this lesson that hoards them in such a way that is only selfish. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24, the author there says, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. So if that's what it is not, then what are treasures, laying up treasures on earth, what is it? What is he saying to us? Well, first of all, I would suggest to you that the idea of worldliness or materialism, however you want to define what he is saying, is a mindset. It's a way that we value things, that we look at the treasures of this earth that are present and tangible, and we make them all important. They are more important to us than God or anything else. I'm going to tell you the danger of this is that there's none of us this morning. I dare say there's none of us this morning that says, I'm guilty of this. That most of us are going to think that we are not this. And yet the danger of it is that when's the last time you ever heard of a church withdrawing from somebody for covetousness? In my lifetime, I have never heard of that. Never known a church that did. And yet, if you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 11, covetousness is mentioned as one of the things you are to separate yourself from a brother who is involved in that. I fear the reason we don't pick that is because they would point a finger right back at us and say, but you are too. And so we're too fearful of the fact that we all are covetous. And when we live in such a wealthy nation that we cannot even possibly imagine until you go to a third world country. Unless you go to a third world country, do you have any clue? Even the poorest people in this country are better fed and taken care of than people that you could go to a third world country and witness the sorrow and the suffering of them and realize how little they will ever possess in this life, that you will spend more this week on eating out than they get to do in sometimes an entire year. We live in an age that values what kind of men? Warren Buffett. I asked all the young people earlier in class, I said, everybody know who Warren Buffett is? Nobody raised their hand. I just always forget that I'm old. Warren Buffett is one of the wealthiest men, if not the most wealthy men on the earth. You think of Bill Gates, you think of all kinds of men that we could list in that name. And if people were to say, what is success? I'll tell you, that's exactly who the world would say success. That's why they go to Warren Buffett all the time. They want to know, what does he think about things? How could we be like Warren Buffett? How could we reach that same goal? I'm going to tell you, here's what Jesus says, Luke 12:15. Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. That's not what life is all about. It's not what true life is all about. Not what life in me even begins to be about. In Luke 16 at verse 14, he said the Pharisees were listening to the parable of the unjust steward, and they said, it says of them, who were lovers of money. Here are people that think they are some of the most spiritually minded people that lived in Jesus' day. If you were to ask anybody, do you think Pharisees are worldly or spiritual? Everybody probably would have answered spiritual. That they set themselves apart from other people in order to do that. And yet comfortably within that situation, they were lovers of money. Do you think it's possible you and I could do the same thing? They heard these things and derided him and said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Ever thought about all the things that this world esteems? I think about many times about Samuel when he went to the house of Eliab to Jesse to anoint David ultimately. But when Eliab came before him, I mean, he must have been a good-looking guy. I mean, Samuel was even moved. Samuel, this godly prophet, said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And God spoke to him, as you know. He said, do not look at him, at the way he looks, for I have rejected him. For man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. Well, it's a lesson when you're young that it takes a while to learn. You know, your good looks are going to fade. Whatever you have is going to sag and is going to wrinkle, and we're not going to be who we were when we look back when we were 18. A girl, when I was in high school for my birthday, gave me 2 tickets, I'm going to date myself, to see the Doobie Brothers. And she gave me 2 tickets. And I was riding around with my dad. I had girls in mind I wanted to take, but she wasn't one of them. And I was riding around with my dad on the farm that I grew up on in West Texas. And I said, Dad, I said, I just don't want to take her out because she's not very good looking. And I'll never forget, he didn't even miss a beat. He turned over and looked at me and said, well, you're no Robert Redford yourself. I kind of looked back to him in stunned silence, but I thought, you know, if your dad tells you you're not Robert Redford, I suppose everybody, I mean, most time moms think you're the gorgeous thing on the planet Earth, but my dad doesn't think it. I'm surely not. I'll tell you, it's got worse. And when time goes along with all of us, we not only come to realize that those things should not matter to us, though everywhere you go in the world, every checkout line at a grocery store, they put on the covers of every magazine, here's what's really important. And you think about people that don't look like that and never will look like that. What value do they have in the eyes of people? And what value do we have in the eyes of people if we think that only wealth measures success? Demas, if you want to think of an example of two opposites. Demas looks at the world, and what does 2 Timothy 4:10 said? He loved it. And he left Paul, and he left God to go back and have all of that. But Moses, who really is at the pinnacle, who had wealth and riches that Demas could never imagine, he looks at all of the trappings of Egypt in Hebrews 11, 25 and 26 and says he esteemed the reproach of Christ to be suffering with Christ and his people were greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt because he judged the reward that both of them were going to offer in the end. Now that's what you and I must do. The thing forbidden, Paul Earnhardt said, is that our treasures and our persons become one. Our treasures and our persons always become one. John R. Stott said, R.W. Stott said, our hearts follow our possessions. Martin Luther long ago said, whenever the gospel is taught and people seek to live according to it, there are two terrible plagues that always arise: false preachers who corrupt the teaching, and Sir Greed, who obstructs right living. That many centuries ago. All of these different people looking and saying, this is what happens, this is the danger. And it's not dealing, folks, with how much we have. Have you ever considered who were in the audience Jesus was speaking to? I mean, if we were to think about the audience he was speaking to, it's not an audience like I'm speaking to this morning. They were not decked out like all of us are decked out. They were people we would put in a third world country, that we would put in the kind of situation that would say, they're in poverty, they're not really wealthy, and yet it's those people, he is saying, you can lay up treasures on this earth instead of treasures in heaven. And if that was so for those people, how much more so is it for us? Earthly treasure, he went on to say, earthly treasures do not last. He talks of moth and rust and thieves. And while that may not mean much to us, in an ancient economy, if you put it in there, you have to think that moths could get into people's clothes, rats and mice could eat all the stored grain, worms could take whatever was put into the ground, as one man said, thieves could break into homes and steal. We still have some of those things that we have to contend with. But nothing would have been safe in the ancient world, and yet it is the same for us, but in different ways. We protect ours now by insecticides and rat poisons and mouse traps and rust-proof paints, as one guy said. But you lose the value of what you have through inflation or devaluation or an economic slump. And how many people do you know that got enamored with the fact that they could make more money and they put it into a Ponzi scheme, brethren, into a Ponzi scheme that they thought was legitimate, dealing with brothers? And it ended up taking everything they had. That many of them had to go back to work and work in order to now see themselves through to retirement when they had reached the time in life that they thought it would not go away. Folks, we delude ourselves to think that anything we possess could not be taken from us like that. That this economy, that this nation that has been built could not be judged by God and all of it vanish in a second. God said to the rich man, fool, this night your soul will be required of you, and when that happens, whose things will they be that you provided? You see, it's not things that are the problem. It is our love for them, as we've been saying, our attachment to them. Paul Earnhardt went on to say in the commentary that he wrote on this section, materialism is destroying many disciples, some even while they are faithfully going to church. He goes on to say, what I didn't put on it, the charade continues, but their heart is no longer in it. Think of people in the Bible that we know that story of. Achan. There are the people of God on the verge of conquering Canaan, and God has just caused the walls to come down in a way that walls do not come down. No army marching around shouting, blowing the trumpets, make a wall fall flat, but God. And yet he was told everything in that city, they were told everything in that city is devoted to me. Destroy everything, burn it, and bring the gold and metal vessels into the tabernacle. And it says that Achan, Joshua 7:21, confessing his sin, when I saw among the spoils, I coveted them. Here among God's people is a man who was clearly told what not to do and yet went into that city and coveted because he saw it. So attractive, so powerful is that attraction. Gehazi, Elisha's servant, you remember? Naaman, who wanted to pay Elisha after he was healed, wanted to give him clothes, wanted to give him silver, and Elisha would not take it. But Gehazi said in his heart, if he won't, I will. And he ran after Naaman and made up a story. And so Naaman even urged him, gave him 2 talents of silver, gave him more than 1 change of clothes. And so he comes back and hides it. And Elisha is made privy to that by God, obviously. And when he comes in, he said, where'd you go, Gehazi? And he said, nowhere. He said, did not my heart go with you when you got the stuff from him? Is it a time, he said, is it a time to have vineyards and male servants and manservants and all these things that go with this life? And God struck Gehazi with leprosy that had been upon Naaman. Folks, we can be the people of God going to church faithfully and be the most materialistic people on planet Earth. The fatal flaw in our character is desiring to be rich. You ever wanted to be rich? Be honest. Have you ever desired to be rich? 1 Timothy 6:9, Paul says, but those who desire to be rich, desire it, fall into temptation, a snare, into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. And folks, I am no different than any of the rest of you. I have wanted to be rich at times. There have been times that I've gotten into this or that, thinking, if I put some effort here, then I'm gonna turn this into money. I don't know if Brother Earnhardt is right, but he goes on to say, not a quote that I put on the overhead for you, but he simply said a statement that we must be people that if we get rich, it's because of hard work, yes, and maybe the blessings of God and other things, but let us never, as he said, have become rich because we planned it that way, because we desired to go that way. Now, boy, that's a tall order. If that's what Scripture is saying to us, then we must dread who we are and what we desire. Because he compares it, if we go back to what Jesus says, to lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. What are we going to take into heaven? Rockefeller, when he died, one of the wealthiest men at his time, one of his aides was asked by somebody, as we always want to know, how much did he have? He asked it this way. He said, how much did he leave? The guy said, all of it. He left all of it. Because we're not going to take any of this stuff, any of this empire, this little part of our empire that we build. None of it is going with us. What's going over there? Us. Us. Where's the treasure that we need to lay up? Christ-likeness. Our character and our deeds are like our master. The treasure is the people that we influence in the same way to take with us over there. The treasure is the certain knowledge that we use the mammon of this world to make those things possible, because that's what's going over there. Lay up treasure that matters is what he's saying to us. And then he says to us, if you go back to the text in verses 22 and 23, that it is a matter of sight. It's a matter of who sees reality, really sees reality. Warren Buffett doesn't see reality. Bill Gates does not see reality. The only way that you see reality is by revelation of what really matters and what all of this will be burned up and taken away. What is beyond? And so Jesus says it's like the eye. The eye illumines the body physically. Think about it. Everything that we do, we almost have to do with our eyes intact. I mean, if you're going to run, it'd be kind of hard for a blind person to run. They make them walk and take the cane and have the dog to help them along the way. But you need to be able to see. You need to be able to, if you're going to drive a car, I can't imagine Anybody doing that? Jump a chasm? Cook or paint? Play ball of any kind? Our eye illumines our body, and therefore it's the window by which the whole body is lighted. But if the eye is unhealthy, if it's diseased, then the whole body is full of darkness. And so he likens that then to the heart of man. And the heart of man, where we fix our eye spiritually, where we look for what is most important to us, that affects our entire being. Whether we are people that are full of light and understand how we ought to live, or people that are in darkness, utter darkness. And so what God asks us is, I want you to be single-minded in your devotion to me. We will light our souls if we see what is valuable in this life. I will fix my eyes on your way, Psalms 119, verse 15. The Gospels of unparalleled value. Ephesians 1:18 then says, the eyes of your understanding being enlightened, that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints. But if at the same time we try to have that world and this world, then many times what will happen to us is that people cannot see the Lord's demands because his demands do not fit into their view of wealth, of what is valuable. That was the rich young ruler's problem, wasn't it? He wanted both. And so he comes and Jesus doesn't counter him with, you've not kept those things in the way as faithfully as a person could. But he said to him, one thing you lack. Go your way, sell whatever you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Come take up your cross and follow me. But he was sad at this word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Could we, like the Pharisees and like the rich young ruler, be comfortable with both? To the extent that we do not realize how it has taken hold of us. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money. And so the last question is the most important of them all in this text. And that is, he asks, who is our master? What do we value? Who do we value the most? Most of us don't like being confronted by stark choices. We don't like hard preaching. I mean, sometimes people come out and say, man, you stepped all over my toes. I say, you ought to try to stand and do that. Because it's not easy to hear or try to understand what Jesus is saying and then convey it in a way that will make meaning to us. That he challenges us and he will never make us comfortable because everything we value is what ought not to be valued if we are left to our own devices. So modern men look at this passage and they say, well, you could work for two employers, not a slave, because that's who he has in mind. It's not about you could work for an employer in the morning and then get off that job and go work for another man, and you could give them both the kind of satisfactory work that they would be satisfied with. But a slave could not do that. In essence, he could never be the property of two masters. Single ownership, total, full-time service is the essence of a slave. And God is saying to us, it's one or the other. You cannot serve both God and man. There's no such thing as a little mammon. I was in a meeting this past week and I stayed with a really fine guy. He's one of the elders of the church there. He's made banking his career. He started a little old country bank. And they grew that bank. And then other people get greedy and make loans they ought not to make and get really out there. Everything collapses. And then he can buy that bank when it goes under. And so that's what they do. They just keep growing and they keep growing and they keep growing. And then he said to me as we were talking this week, I know a lot of wealthy people, he said. We've sold out of everything. There are more people that have been made millionaires by oil than anything else, he said, I think. But he said, every last one of them is miserable. Absolutely and totally, their lives are wrecks. And yet we want a little. We want to make sure that we have a little. But materialism has a voracious appetite that sooner or later is going to crowd out God. Paul Earnhardt said, for each of us, there is only one brief and fragile lifetime in which to choose the treasure that will fashion our eternity. How old are you? In 2 weeks, I'll be old enough to vote. I'll be 56. You know how much time I've wasted in the wrong pursuits? How much time have you wasted in the wrong pursuit? There's no such thing as giving a trifle to God. That is an insult at the highest level to Him. Do you think we could put stuff of this earth and make it equal to the great and majestic Father of heaven? The God who loved us so much that He sent His only begotten Son to this earth in order that we might perish in our sins, who would go to all the lengths to bring us back to Him, who puts up with us. When I think I see what I do on the evening news and I get so disgusted, people tell me they quit watching Fox, they quit watching everything else, they just don't want to know. And I think God knows everything in every second of all the sordid and disgusting things that are done by human beings everywhere to other human beings. And yet in long-suffering patience, He goes on and loves us and tries one more day, one more time to bring us to Him. And then for us to think we can be in both camps, what an insult to His majesty. So how are we going to overcome it? I just want to suggest some things to you. I have no idea. First time that I'm going to suggest some of these things, so you tackle me. Tell me if you think they'll work. First of all, we need a sober awakening. I want you, if you will, to pretend you are that rich young ruler. I want you seriously. You know, we always get to that passage, and what's the first thing we say when we're in a Bible class? Well, He didn't command you and me to do that. It's almost the first thing we say. I understand that. Because of other passages that talk about people having things, so they sold them in order to be able to give so that people could have. I understand that. Those people obviously have possessed them. But for sake of argument, just pretend with me that that command is given to us. Would you be willing to divest yourself of everything you have and go out and give it to the poor and then come follow Jesus? What does that mean? What does that lifestyle mean after that? Pretend that you could joyfully, to use another passage, accept the plundering of your goods for the sake of Jesus Christ. What I'm trying to say to you and to me is we need a sobering awakening. How am I going to know I'm not wedded to this stuff? I need a sense of urgency in that I need to know that mammon does not take up in my life the rule. So what am I going to do to try to show myself that? Well, I need to remember what God said I better do with it. In 1 Timothy 6:18, let them do good that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. You know, we always read that passage and it's written to the rich people. And who are you thinking about? You're thinking about that guy in the congregation that has that business he sold for several million. That's the guy you're thinking about. Where if we remember who Paul is writing to, mostly slaves in a Roman Empire, slaves that are different than we would think of slaves. Some of them could own property and do all kinds of things like that. But nonetheless, we're not talking about the upper crust or echelon. There could be every kind of social economic level in those churches, and yet that same thing would go out. If you were to think of all of us compared to them, there is nothing but filthy rich people here.
Let them do good and be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share. So what are good works? To the rich man, he said, give to the poor. Paul and was told the same thing by Peter, James, and John. When James, Cephas, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that had been given to me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. They desired only that we would remember the poor, the very thing which I was also eager to do. Dorcas, who were told a woman full of good works and charitable deeds that she did, provided all these garments for the widows. Famine in Uganda, how many things could we label? Let us do what God said. And then let me suggest one last thing to you, and I want you to test me on this. Should we do something radical so that we can show ourselves we are not wedded to this stuff? Should we give in a way that cost us? You ever thought about all the money that we send to Uganda right now, some of us in different churches and individuals are, to feed the famine? I bet it didn't even pinch us. I bet the stuff I know that I gave, it's excess. It's the treasury. All these guys walking by casting in their big amounts of money. And here comes one poor widow who cast in like a copper penny. And Jesus, looking at all of them, knowing their hearts, said, she cast in more than everybody else. They gave, listen to him, of their abundance. But she, out of her poverty, has put in all that she had. That's who God is looking for, a heart that is fully given to him. That we will begin maybe to know if we give in a way that cost us. I'm not talking about to preachers necessarily. I have more than enough. Every preacher I know in America has more than enough. I'm talking about the things that the Bible would say we should give to it. And so instead of Hawaii this year or Colorado skiing, what about going to preach the gospel with brothers that go to Ethiopia and Vietnam and Uganda and Botswana and Sierra Leone and India? And take your family with you. And spend your money for those things that go beyond this world. The Sermon on the Mount, lastly, was meant to radically alter us or do nothing at all. It's not a part process. We either change or we have not changed. There's a quote that I have always loved from the Star Wars movies. One day I put it up on the screen and a guy came out later and said, seriously, you put Star Wars up there? I said, it's a great quote. When Luke says that he'll give it a try, and that little green guy, Yoda, said, no, do or not do. There is no try. It's a great quote. Do or not do. There is no try. You're subject to heaven's invitation this morning. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. If we can help you to come to him, we'd hope that you know enough to obey the gospel. But if you need to study and know more, then I know Jeff, Matt, others in this congregation will be glad to study. While together we stand and sing.